This is Audible.
Interpreter of Maladies by Jhumpa Lahiri. This is Matilda Novak. A Temporary Matter. The notice informed them that it was a temporary matter. For 5 days, their electricity would be cut off for 1 hour, beginning at 8 p.m. A line had gone down in the last snowstorm, and the repairmen were going to take advantage of the milder evenings to set it right. The work would affect only the houses on the quiet, tree-lined street, within walking distance of a row of brick-faced stores and a trolley shop where Shobha and Shukumar had lived for 3 years. "It's good of them to warn us," Shobha conceded after reading the notice aloud, more for her own benefit than Shukumar's. She let the strap of her leather satchel, plump with files, slip from her shoulders and left it in the hallway as she walked into the kitchen. She wore a navy blue poplin raincoat over gray sweatpants and white sneakers, looking, at 33, like the type of woman she'd once claimed she would never resemble. She'd come from the gym. Her cranberry lipstick was visible only on the outer reaches of her mouth, and her eyeliner had left charcoal patches beneath her lower lashes. She used to look this way sometimes, Shukumar thought, on mornings after a party, or a night at a bar when she'd been too lazy to wash her face, too eager to collapse into his arms. She dropped a sheaf of mail on the table without a glance. Her eyes were still fixed on the notice in her other hand. "But they should do this sort of thing during the day."
"When I'm here, you mean," Shukumar said. He put a glass lid on a pot of lamb, adjusting it so only the slightest bit of steam could escape. Since January, he'd been working at home, trying to complete the final chapters of his dissertation on agrarian revolts in India. "When do the repairs start?"
"It says March 19th. Is today the 19th?
Shobha walked over to the framed corkboard that hung on the wall by the fridge, bare except for a calendar of William Morris wallpaper patterns. She looked at it as if for the first time, studying the wallpaper pattern carefully on the top half before allowing her eyes to fall on the numbered grid at the bottom. A friend had sent the calendar in the mail as a Christmas gift, even though Shobha and Shukumar hadn't celebrated Christmas that year.
"Today, then," Shobha announced. "You have a dentist appointment next Friday, by the way."
He ran his tongue over the tops of his teeth. He'd forgotten to brush them that morning. It wasn't the first time. He hadn't left the house at all that day, or the day before. The more Shobha stayed out, the more she began putting in extra hours at work and taking on additional projects, the more he wanted to stay in, not even leaving to get the mail, or to buy fruit or wine at the stores by the trolley stop. 6 months ago, in September, Shukumar was at an academic conference in Baltimore when Shobha went into labor, 3 weeks before her due date. He hadn't wanted to go to the conference, but she had insisted. It was important to make contacts, and he would be entering the job market next year. She told him that she had his number at the hotel and a copy of his schedule and flight numbers, and she had arranged with her friend Jillian for a ride to the hospital in the event of an emergency. When the cab pulled away that morning for the airport, Shobha stood waving goodbye in her robe, with one arm resting on the mound of her belly as if it were a perfectly natural part of her body. Every time he thought of that moment, the last moment he saw Shobha pregnant, it was the cab he remembered most. A station wagon, painted red with blue lettering. It was cavernous compared to their own car. Although Shukumar was 6 feet tall, with hands too big to ever rest comfortably in the pocket of his jeans, he felt dwarfed in the back seat. As the cab sped down Beacon Street, he imagined a day when he and Shobha might need to buy a station wagon of their own to cart their children back and forth from music lessons and dentist appointments. He imagined himself gripping the wheel as Shobha turned around to hand the children juice boxes. Once these images of parenthood had troubled Shukumar, adding to his anxiety that he was still a student at 35. But that early autumn morning, the trees still heavy with bronze leaves, he welcomed the image for the first time. A member of the staff had found him somehow among the identical convention rooms and handed him a stiff square of stationery. It was only a telephone number, but Shukumar knew it was a hospital. When he returned to Boston, it was over. The baby had been born dead. Shobha was lying on a bed, asleep, in a private room so small there was barely enough space to stand beside her. in a wing of the hospital they hadn't been to on the tour for expectant parents. Her placenta had weakened and she'd had a cesarean, though not quickly enough. The doctor explained that these things happen. He smiled in the kindest way it was possible to smile at people known only professionally. Shoba would be back on her feet in a few weeks. There was nothing to indicate that she would not be able to have children in the future. These days, Shoba was always gone by the time Shukumar woke up. He would open his eyes and see the long black hair she shed on the pillow and think of her, dressed, sipping her third cup of coffee already, in her office downtown, where she searched for typographical errors in textbooks and marked them in a code she had once explained to him with an assortment of colored pencils. She would do the same for his dissertation, she promised, when it was ready. He envied her the specificity of her task, so unlike the elusive nature of his. He was a mediocre student who had a facility for absorbing details without curiosity. Until September, he had been diligent, if not dedicated, summarizing chapters, outlining arguments on pads of yellow-lined paper. But now, he would lie in their bed until he grew bored, gazing at his side of the closet, which Shoba always left partly open, at the row of tweed jackets and corduroy trousers he would not have to choose from to teach his classes that semester. After the baby died, it was too late to withdraw from his teaching duties, but his advisor had arranged things so that he had the spring semester to himself. Shukumar was in his sixth year of graduate school. "That and the summer should give you a good push," his advisor had said. "You should be able to wrap things up by next September." But nothing was pushing Shukumar. Instead, he thought of how he and Shoba had become experts at avoiding each other in their three-bedroom house, spending as much time on separate floors as possible. He thought of how he no longer looked forward to weekends, when she sat for hours on the sofa with her colored pencils and her files, so that he feared that putting on a record in his own house might be rude. He thought of how long it had been since she looked into his eyes and smiled, or whispered his name on those rare occasions they still reached for each other's bodies before sleeping. In the beginning, he had believed that it would pass, that he and Shoba would get through it all somehow. She was only 33. She was strong, on her feet again. But it wasn't a consolation. It was often nearly lunchtime when Shukumar would finally pull himself out of bed and head downstairs to the coffee pot, pouring out the extra bit Shoba left for him, along with an empty mug, on the countertop. Shukumar gathered onion skins in his hands and let them drop into the garbage pail, on top of the ribbons of fat he'd trimmed from the lamb. He ran the water in the sink, soaking the knife and the cutting board, and rubbed a lemon half along his fingers to get rid of the garlic smell, a trick he'd learned from Shoba. It was 7:30. Through the window he saw the sky like soft black pitch. Uneven banks of snow still lined the sidewalks, though it was warm enough for people to walk about without hats or gloves. Nearly 3 feet had fallen in the last storm, so that for a week people had to walk single file in narrow trenches. For a week, that was Shukumar's excuse for not leaving the house. But now the trenches were widening, and the water drained steadily into grates in the pavement. "The lamb won't be done by 8:00, Shukumar said. "We may have to eat in the dark." "We can light candles," Shoba suggested. She unclipped her hair, coiled neatly at the nape during the days, and pried the sneakers from her feet without untying them. "I'm going to shower before the lights go," she said, heading for the staircase. "I'll be down." Shukumar moved her satchel and her sneakers to the side of the fridge. She wasn't this way before. She used to put her coat on a hanger, her sneakers in the closet, and she paid bills as soon as they came. But now she treated the house as if it were a hotel. The fact that the yellow chintz armchair in the living room clashed with the blue and maroon Turkish carpet no longer bothered her. On the enclosed porch at the back of the house, a crisp white bag still sat on the wicker chaise, filled with lace she had once planned to turn into curtains. While Shoba showered, Shukumar went into the downstairs bathroom and found a new toothbrush in its box beneath the sink. The cheap, stiff bristles hurt his gums, and he spit some blood into the basin. The spare brush was one of many stored in a metal basket. Shoba had bought them once when they were on sale, in the event that a visitor decided at the last minute to spend the night. It was typical of her. She was the type to prepare for surprises, good and bad. If she found a skirt or a purse she liked, she bought two. She kept the bonuses from her job in a separate bank account in her name. It hadn't bothered him. His own mother had fallen to pieces when his father died, abandoning the house he grew up in and moving back to Calcutta, leaving Shukumar to settle it all. He liked that Shobha was different. It astonished him, her capacity to think ahead. When she used to do the shopping, the pantry was always stocked with extra bottles of olive and corn oil, depending on whether they were cooking Italian or Indian. There were endless boxes of pasta in all shapes and colors, zippered sacks of basmati rice, whole sides of lambs and goats from the Muslim butchers at Haymarket, chopped up and frozen in endless plastic bags. Every other Saturday, they wound through the maze of stalls Shukumar eventually knew by heart. He watched in disbelief as she bought more food, trailing behind her with canvas bags as she pushed through the crowd, arguing under the morning sun with boys too young to shave but already missing teeth, who twisted up brown paper bags of artichokes, plums, ginger root, and yams, and dropped them on their scales and tossed them to Shobha one by one. She didn't mind being jostled, even when she was pregnant. She was tall and broad-shouldered, with hips that her obstetrician assured her were made for childbearing. During the drive back home, as the car curved along the Charles, they invariably marveled at how much food they'd bought. It never went to waste. When friends dropped by, Shobha would throw together meals that appeared to have taken half a day to prepare, from things that she had frozen and bottled, not cheap things in tins, but peppers she had marinated herself with rosemary and chutneys that she'd cooked on Sundays, stirring boiling pots of tomatoes and prunes. Her labeled mason jars lined the shelves of the kitchen in endless sealed pyramids, enough, they'd agreed, to last for their grandchildren to taste. They'd eaten it all by now. Shukumar had been going through their supplies steadily, preparing meals for the two of them, measuring out cupfuls of rice, defrosting bags of meat day after day. He combed through her cookbooks every afternoon, following her penciled instructions to use 2 teaspoons of ground coriander seeds instead of one, or red lentils instead of yellow. Each of the recipes was dated, telling the first time they had eaten that dish together. April 2nd, cauliflower with fennel. January 14th, chicken with almonds and sultanas. He had no memory of eating those meals, and yet there they were, recorded in her neat proofreader's hand. Shukumar enjoyed cooking now. It was the one thing that made him feel productive. If it weren't for him, he knew, Shobha would eat a bowl of cereal for dinner. Tonight, with no lights, they would have to eat together. For months now, they'd served themselves from the stove, and he'd taken his plate into his study, letting the meal grow cold on his desk before shoving it into his mouth without pause, while Shobha took her plate to the living room and watched game shows or proofread files with her arsenal of colored pencils at hand. At some point in the evening, she visited him. When he heard her approach, he would put away his novel and begin typing sentences. She would rest her hands on his shoulders and stare with him into the blue glow of the computer screen. "Don't work too hard," she would say after a minute or two, and head off to bed. It was the one time in the day she sought him out, and yet he'd come to dread it. He knew it was something she forced herself to do. She would look around the walls of the room, which they had decorated together last summer, with a border of marching ducks and rabbits playing trumpets and drums. By the end of August, there was a cherry crib under the window, a white changing table with mint-green knobs, and a rocking chair with checkered cushions. Shukumar had disassembled it all before bringing Shobha back from the hospital, scraping off the rabbits and ducks with a spatula. For some reason, the room did not haunt him the way it haunted Shobha. In January, when he stopped working at his carrel in the library, he set up his desk there deliberately, partly because the room soothed him, and partly because it was a place Shobha avoided. Shukumar returned to the kitchen and began to open drawers. He tried to locate a candle among the scissors, the egg beaters and whisks, the mortar and pestle she'd bought in a bazaar in Calcutta, and used to pound garlic cloves and cardamom pods, back when she used to cook. He found a flashlight, but no batteries, and a half-empty box of birthday candles. Shobha had thrown him a surprise birthday party last May. 120 people had crammed into the house, all the friends and the friends of friends they now systematically avoided. Bottles of vino verde had nested in a bed of ice in the bathtub. Shobha was in her fifth month, drinking ginger ale from a martini glass. She had made a vanilla cream cake with custard and spun sugar. All night she kept Shukumar's long fingers linked with hers as they walked among the guests at the party. Since September, their only guest had been Shobha's mother. She came from Arizona and stayed with them for 2 months after Shobha returned from the hospital. She cooked dinner every night, drove herself to the supermarket, washed their clothes, put them away. She was a religious woman. She set up a small shrine, a framed picture of a lavender-faced goddess and a plate of marigold petals on the bedside table in the guest room, and prayed twice a day for healthy grandchildren in the future. She was polite to Shukumar without being friendly. She folded his sweaters with an expertise she had learned from her job in a department store. She replaced a missing button on his winter coat and knit him a beige and brown scarf, presenting it to him without the least bit of ceremony, as if he had only dropped it and hadn't noticed. She never talked to him about Shobha. Once, when he mentioned the baby's death, she looked up from her knitting and said, "But you weren't even there." It struck him as odd that there were no real candles in the house, that Shobha hadn't prepared for such an ordinary emergency. He looked now for something to put the birthday candles in, and settled on the soil of a potted ivy that normally sat on the windowsill over the sink. Even though the plant was inches from the tap, the soil was so dry that he had to water it first before the candles would stand straight. He pushed aside the things on the kitchen table, the piles of mail, the unread library books. He remembered their first meals there, when they were so thrilled to be married, to be living together in the same house at last, when they would just reach for each other foolishly, more eager to make love than to eat. He put down 2 embroidered placemats, a wedding gift from an uncle in Lucknow, and set out the plates and wine glasses they usually saved for guests. He put the ivy in the middle, the white-edged, star-shaped leaves girded by 10 little candles. He switched on the digital clock radio and tuned it to a jazz station. "What's all this?" Shobha said when she came downstairs. Her hair was wrapped in a thick white towel. She undid the towel and draped it over a chair, allowing her hair, damp and dark, to fall across her back. As she walked absently toward the stove, she took out a few tangles with her fingers. She wore a clean pair of sweatpants, a t-shirt, an old flannel robe. Her stomach was flat again, her waist narrow before the flare of her hips, the belt of the robe tied in a floppy knot. It was nearly 8. Shukumar put the rice on the table and the lentils from the night before into the microwave oven, punching the numbers on the timer. "You made rogan josh," Shobha observed, looking through the glass lid at the bright paprika stew. Shukumar took out a piece of lamb, pinching it quickly between his fingers so as not to scald himself. He prodded a larger piece with a serving spoon to make sure the meat slipped easily from the bone. "It's ready," he announced. The microwave had just beeped when the lights went out and the music disappeared. "Perfect timing," Shobha said. "All I could find were birthday candles." He lit up the ivy, keeping the rest of the candles and a book of matches by his plate. "It doesn't matter," she said, running a finger along the stem of her wine glass. "It looks lovely." In the dimness, he knew how she sat, a bit forward in her chair, ankles crossed against the lowest rung, left elbow on the table. During his search for the candles, Shukumar had found a bottle of wine in a crate he had thought was empty. He clamped the bottle between his knees while he turned in the corkscrew. He worried about spilling, and so he picked up the glasses and held them close to his lap while he filled them. They served themselves, stirring the rice with their forks, squinting as they extracted bay leaves and cloves from the stew. Every few minutes, Shukumar lit a few more birthday candles and drove them into the soil of the pot. "It's like India," Shobha said, watching him tend his makeshift candelabra. "Sometimes the current disappears for hours at a stretch. I once had to attend an entire rice ceremony in the dark. The baby just cried and cried. It must have been so hot." Their baby had never cried, Shukumar considered. Their baby would never have a rice ceremony, even though Shobha had already made the guest list, and decided on which of her 3 brothers she was going to ask to feed the child its first taste of solid food, at 6 months if it was a boy, 7 if it was a girl. "Are you hot?" he asked her. He pushed the blazing ivy pot to the other end of the table, closer to the piles of books and mail, making it even more difficult for them to see each other. He was suddenly irritated that he couldn't go upstairs and sit in front of the computer. "No, it's delicious," she said, tapping her plate with her fork. "It really is." He refilled the wine in her glass. She thanked him. They weren't like this before. Now he had to struggle to say something that interested her, something that made her look up from her plate or from her proofreading files. Eventually, he gave up trying to amuse her. He learned not to mind the silences. "I remember, during power failures at my grandmother's house, we all had to say something," Shoba continued. He could barely see her face, but from her tone, he knew her eyes were narrowed, as if trying to focus on a distant object. It was a habit of hers. "Like what?" "I don't know, a little poem, a joke, a fact about the world. For some reason, my relatives always wanted me to tell them the names of my friends in America. I don't know why the information was so interesting to them. The last time I saw my aunt, she asked after four girls I went to elementary school with in Tucson. I barely remember them now." Shukumar hadn't spent as much time in India as Shoba had. His parents, who settled in New Hampshire, used to go back without him. The first time he'd gone as an infant, he'd nearly died of amoebic dysentery. His father, a nervous type, was afraid to take him again in case something were to happen, and left him with an aunt and uncle in Concord. As a teenager, he preferred sailing camp or scooping ice cream during the summers to going to Calcutta. It wasn't until after his father died, in his last year of college, that the country began to interest him, and he studied its history from course books as if it were any other subject. He wished now that he had his own childhood story of India. "Let's do that," she said suddenly.
"Do what?"
"Say something to each other in the dark."
"Like what? I don't know any jokes."
"No, no jokes." She thought for a minute. "How about telling each other something we've never told before?"
"I used to play this game in high school," Shukumar recalled, "when I got drunk."
"You're thinking of truth or dare. This is different. Okay, I'll start."
She took a sip of wine.
"The first time I was alone in your apartment, I looked in your address book to see if you'd written me in. I think we'd known each other 2 weeks.
"Where was I?"
"You went to answer the telephone in the other room. It was your mother, and I figured it would be a long call. I wanted to know if you'd promoted me from the margins of your newspaper."
"Had I?"
"No, but I didn't give up on you. Now it's your turn."
He couldn't think of anything, but Shoba was waiting for him to speak. She hadn't appeared so determined in months. What was there left to say to her? He thought back to their first meeting 4 years earlier in a lecture hall in Cambridge, where a group of Bengali poets were giving a recital. They'd ended up side by side on folding wooden chairs. Shukumar was soon bored. He was unable to decipher the literary diction and couldn't join the rest of the audience as they sighed and nodded solemnly after certain phrases. Peering at the newspaper folded in his lap, he studied the temperatures of cities around the world. 91 degrees in Singapore yesterday, 51 in Stockholm. When he turned his head to the left, he saw a woman next to him making a grocery list on the back of a folder, and was startled to find that she was beautiful. "Okay," he said, remembering.
"The first time we went out to dinner, to the Portuguese place, I forgot to tip the waiter. I went back the next morning, found out his name, left money with the manager." "You went all the way back to Somerville just to tip a waiter?"
"I took a cab."
"Why did you forget to tip the waiter?"
The birthday candles had burned out, but he pictured her face clearly in the dark, the wide, tilting eyes, the full grape-toned lips, the fall at age two from her high chair still visible as a comma on her chin. Each day, Shukumar noticed, her beauty, which had once overwhelmed him, seemed to fade. The cosmetics that had seemed superfluous were necessary now, not to improve her but to define her somehow. "By the end of the meal, I had a funny feeling that I might marry you," he said, admitting it to himself as well as to her for the first time. "It must have distracted me." The next night, Shoba came home earlier than usual. There was lamb left over from the evening before, and Shukumar heated it up so that they were able to eat by 7. He'd gone out that day, through the melting snow, and bought a packet of taper candles from the corner store and batteries to fit the flashlight. He had the candles ready on the countertop, standing in brass holders shaped like lotuses, but they ate under the glow of the copper-shaded ceiling lamp that hung over the table. When they had finished eating, Shukumar was surprised to see that Shoba was stacking her plate on top of his and then carrying them over to the sink. He had assumed she would retreat to the living room behind her barricade of files. "Don't worry about the dishes," he said, taking them from her hands.
"It seems silly not to," she replied,
pouring a drop of detergent onto a sponge.
"It's nearly 8 o'clock."
His heart quickened. All day Shukumar had looked forward to the lights going out. He thought about what Shoba had said the night before, about looking in his address book. It felt good to remember her as she was then. How bold yet nervous she'd been when they first met. How hopeful. They stood side by side at the sink, their reflections fitting together in the frame of the window. It made him shy, the way he felt the first time they stood together in a mirror. He couldn't recall the last time they'd been photographed. They had stopped attending parties, went nowhere together. The film in his camera still contained pictures of Shoba in the yard when she was pregnant. After finishing the dishes, they leaned against the counter, drying their hands on either end of a towel. At 8 o'clock, the house went black. Shukumar lit the wicks of the candles, impressed by their long, steady flames.
"Let's sit outside," Shoba said. "I think it's warm still."
They each took a candle and sat down on the steps. It seemed strange to be sitting outside with patches of snow still on the ground. But everyone was out of their houses tonight, the air fresh enough to make people restless. Screen doors opened and closed. A small parade of neighbors passed by with flashlights.
"We're going out to the bookstore to browse,"
a silver-haired man called out. He was walking with his wife, a thin woman in a windbreaker, and holding a dog on a leash. They were the Bradfords, and they had tucked a sympathy card into Shoba and Shukumar's mailbox back in September.
"I hear they've got their power."
"They'd better," Shukumar said, "or you'll be browsing in the dark." The woman laughed, slipping her arm through the crook of her husband's elbow.
"Want to join us?"
"No, thanks,"
Shoba and Shukumar called out together. It surprised Shukumar that his words matched hers. He wondered what Shoba would tell him in the dark. The worst possibilities had already run through his head. That she'd had an affair, that she didn't respect him for being 35 and still a student, that she blamed him for being in Baltimore the way her mother did. But he knew those things weren't true. She'd been faithful, as had he. She believed in him. It was she who had insisted he go to Baltimore. What didn't they know about each other? He knew she curled her fingers tightly when she slept, that her body twitched during bad dreams. He knew it was honeydew she favored over cantaloupe. He knew that when they returned from the hospital, the first thing she did when she walked into the house was pick out objects of theirs and toss them into a pile in the hallway. Books from the shelves, plants from the windowsills, paintings from the walls, photos from tables, pots and pans that hung from the hooks over the stove. Shukumar had stepped out of her way, watching as she moved methodically from room to room. When she was satisfied, she stood there, staring at the pile she'd made, her lips drawn back in such distaste that Shukumar had thought she would spit. Then she'd started to cry. He began to feel cold as he sat there on the steps. He felt that he needed her to talk first, in order to reciprocate.
"That time when your mother came to visit us," she said finally. "When I said one night that I had to stay late at work, I went out with Jillian and had a martini."
He looked at her profile, the slender nose, the slightly masculine set of her jaw. He remembered that night well, eating with his mother, tired from teaching two classes back to back, wishing Shoba were there to say more of the right things because he had come up with only the wrong ones. It had been 12 years since his father had died, and his mother had come to spend 2 weeks with him and Shoba so they could honor his father's memory together. Each night his mother cooked something his father had liked, but she was too upset to eat the dishes herself, and her eyes would well up as Shoba stroked her hand. "It's so touching,"
Shoba had said to him at the time. Now he pictured Shoba with Jillian in a bar with striped velvet sofas, the one they used to go to after the movies, making sure she got her extra olive, asking Jillian for a cigarette. He imagined her complaining and Jillian sympathizing about visits from in-laws. It was Jillian who had driven Shoba to the hospital.
"Your turn,"
she said, stopping his thoughts.
At the end of their street, Shukumar heard sounds of a drill and the electricians shouting over it. He looked at the darkened facades of the houses lining the street. Candles glowed in the windows of one. In spite of the warmth, smoke rose from the chimney.
"I cheated on my Oriental Civilization exam in college," he said. "It was my last semester, my last set of exams. My father had died a few months before. I could see the blue book of the guy next to me. He was an American guy, a maniac. He knew Urdu and Sanskrit. I couldn't remember if the verse we had to identify was an example of Ghazal or not. I looked at his answer and copied it down."
It had happened over 15 years ago. He felt relief now, having told her.
She turned to him, looking not at his face but at his shoes. Old moccasins he wore as if they were slippers, the leather at the back permanently flattened.
He wondered if it bothered her, what he'd said.
She took his hand and pressed it.
"You didn't have to tell me why you did it," she said, moving closer to him. They sat together until 9 o'clock, when the lights came on. They heard some people across the street, clapping from their porch, and televisions being turned on. The Bradfords walked back down the street, eating ice cream cones and waving. Shoba and Shukumar waved back. Then they stood up, his hand still in hers, and went inside. Somehow, without saying anything, it had turned into this, into an exchange of confessions. The little ways they'd hurt or disappointed each other, and themselves. The following day, Shukumar thought for hours about what to say to her. He was torn between admitting that he had once ripped out a photo of a woman in one of the fashion magazines she used to subscribe to and carried it in his books for a week, or saying that he really hadn't lost the sweater vest she bought him for their third wedding anniversary, but had exchanged it for cash at Feline's, and that he had gotten drunk alone in the middle of a day at a hotel bar. For their first anniversary, Shoba had cooked a 10-course dinner just for him. The vest depressed him.
"My wife gave me a sweater vest for our anniversary," he complained to the bartender, his head heavy with cognac. "What do you expect?" the bartender had replied. "You're married."
As for the picture of the woman, he didn't know why he'd ripped it out. She wasn't as pretty as Shoba. She wore a white sequined dress and had a sullen face and lean, mannish legs. Her bare arms were raised, her fists around her head, as if she were about to punch herself in the ears. It was an advertisement for stockings. Shoba had been pregnant at the time, her stomach suddenly immense, to the point where Shukumar no longer wanted to touch her. The first time he saw the picture, he was lying in bed next to her, watching her as she read. When he noticed the magazine in the recycling pile, he found the woman and tore out the page as carefully as he could. For about a week, he allowed himself a glimpse each day. He felt an intense desire for the woman, but it was a desire that turned to disgust after a minute or two. It was the closest he'd come to infidelity. He told Shoba about the sweater on the third night, the picture on the fourth. She said nothing as he spoke, expressed no protest or reproach. She simply listened, and then she took his hand, pressing it as she had before. On the third night, she told him that once, after a lecture they'd attended, she let him speak to the chairman of his department without telling him that there had been a dab of pâté on his chin. She'd been irritated with him for some reason, and so she'd let him go on and on about securing his fellowship for the following semester without putting a finger to her own chin as a signal. The fourth night, she said that she never liked the one poem he'd ever published in his life in a literary magazine in Utah. He'd written the poem after meeting Shoba. She added that she found the poem sentimental. Something happened when the house was dark. They were able to talk to each other again. The third night, after supper, they'd sat together on the sofa, and once it was dark, he began kissing her awkwardly on her forehead and her face, and though it was dark, he closed his eyes and knew that she did too. The fourth night, they walked carefully upstairs to bed, feeling together for the final step with their feet before the landing, and making love with a desperation they had forgotten. She wept without sound, and whispered his name, and traced his eyebrows with her finger in the dark. As he made love to her, he wondered what he would say the next night, and what she would say, the thought of it exciting him. "Hold me," he said. "Hold me in your arms." By the time the lights came back on downstairs, they'd fallen asleep. The morning of the fifth night, Shukumar found another notice from the electric company in the mailbox. The line had been repaired ahead of schedule, it said. He was disappointed. He had planned on making shrimp malai for Shoba, but when he arrived at the store, he didn't feel like cooking anymore. It wasn't the same, he thought, knowing the lights wouldn't go out. In the store, the shrimp looked gray and thin. The coconut milk tin was dusty and overpriced. Still, he bought them, along with a beeswax candle and two bottles of wine. She came home at 7:30.
"I suppose this is the end of our game," he said, when he saw her reading the notice.
She looked at him. "You can still light the candles if you want." She hadn't been to the gym tonight. She wore a suit beneath the raincoat. Her makeup had been retouched recently. When she went upstairs to change, Shukumar poured himself some wine and put on a record, a Thelonious Monk album he knew she liked. When she came downstairs, they ate together. She didn't thank him or compliment him. They simply ate in a darkened room, in the glow of a beeswax candle. They had survived a difficult time. They finished off the shrimp. They finished off the first bottle of wine and moved on to the second. They sat together until the candle had nearly burned away. She shifted in her chair, and Shukumar thought she was about to say something. But instead, she blew out the candle, stood up, turned on the light switch, and sat down again.
"Shouldn't we keep the lights off?" Shukumar asked.
She set her plate aside and clasped her hands on the table. "I want you to see my face when I tell you this," she said gently.
His heart began to pound.
The day she told him she was pregnant, she had used the very same words, saying them in the same gentle way, turning off the basketball game he'd been watching on television. He hadn't been prepared then. Now he was. Only he didn't want her to be pregnant again. He didn't want to have to pretend to be happy. "I've been looking for an apartment, and I've found one," she said, narrowing her eyes on something, it seemed, behind his left shoulder. "It was nobody's fault," she continued. "They'd been through enough. She needed some time alone. She had money saved up for a security deposit. The apartment was on Beacon Hill, so she could walk to work. She had signed the lease that night before coming home." She wouldn't look at him, but he stared at her. It was obvious that she'd rehearsed the lines. All this time she'd been looking for an apartment, testing the water pressure, asking a realtor if the heat and hot water were included in the rent. It sickened Shukumar, knowing that she had spent these past evenings preparing for a life without him. He was relieved, and yet he was sickened. This was what she'd been trying to tell him for the past four evenings. This was the point of her game. Now it was his turn to speak. There was something he'd sworn he would never tell her, and for 6 months he had done his best to block it from his mind. Before the ultrasound, she had asked the doctor not to tell her the sex of their child, and Shukumar had agreed. She had wanted it to be a surprise. Later, those few times they talked about what had happened, she said at least they'd been spared that knowledge. In a way, she almost took pride in her decision, for it enabled her to seek refuge in a mystery. He knew she assumed it was a mystery for him, too. He had arrived too late from Baltimore, when it was all over and she was lying on the hospital bed. But he hadn't. He'd arrived early enough to see their baby, and to hold him, before they'd cremated him. At first he had recoiled at the suggestion, but the doctor had said holding the baby might help him with the process of grieving. Shoba was asleep, The baby had been cleaned off, his bulbous lids shut tight to the world.
"Our baby was a boy," he said. His skin was more red than brown. He had black hair on his head. He weighed almost 5 pounds. His fingers were curled shut just like yours in the night.
Shoba looked at him now, her face contorted with sorrow. He had cheated on a college exam, ripped a picture of a woman out of a magazine. He had returned a sweater and got drunk in the middle of the day instead. These were the things he had told her. He had held his son, who had known life only within her, against his chest in a darkened room in an unknown wing of the hospital. He had held him until a nurse knocked and took him away. And he promised himself that day that he would never tell Shoba, because he still loved her then, and it was the one thing in her life that she had wanted to be a surprise. Shukumar stood up and stacked his plate on top of hers. He carried the plates to the sink, but instead of running the tap, he looked out the window. Outside, the evening was still warm, and the Bradfords were walking arm in arm. As he watched the couple, the room went dark, and he spun around. Shoba had turned the lights off. She came back to the table and sat down, and after a moment, Shukumar joined her. They wept together for the things they now knew.
When Mr. Pirzada came to dine. In the autumn of 1971, a man used to come to our house, bearing confections in his pocket and hopes of ascertaining the life or death of his family. His name was Mr. Pirzada, and he came from Dhaka, now the capital of Bangladesh, but then a part of Pakistan. That year, Pakistan was engaged in civil war. The eastern frontier, where Dhaka was located, was fighting for autonomy from the ruling regime in the west. In March, Dhaka had been invaded, torched, and shelled by the Pakistani army. Teachers were dragged into streets and shot, women dragged into barracks and raped. By the end of the summer, 300,000 people were said to have died. In Dhaka, Mr. Pirzada had a 3-story home, a lectureship in botany at the university, a wife of 20 years, and 7 daughters between the ages of 6 and 16, whose names all began with the letter A. Their mother's idea, he explained one day, producing from his wallet a black and white picture of 7 girls at a picnic, their braids tied with ribbons, sitting cross-legged in a row, eating chicken curry off of banana leaves. "How am I to distinguish? Aisha, Amira, Amina, Aziza, you see the difficulty." Each week, Mr. Pirzada wrote letters to his wife and sent comic books to each of his 7 daughters, but the postal system, along with most everything else in Dhaka, had collapsed, and he had not heard word of them in over 6 months. Mr. Pirzada, meanwhile, was in America for the year, for he had been awarded a grant from the government of Pakistan to study the foliage of New England. In spring and summer, he had gathered data in Vermont and Maine, and in autumn, he moved to a university north of Boston, where we lived, to write a short book about his discoveries. The grant was a great honor, but when converted into dollars, it was not generous. As a result, Mr. Pirzada lived in a room in a graduate dormitory and did not own a proper stove or a television set of his own. And so he came to our house to eat dinner and watch the evening news. At first, I knew nothing of the reason for his visits. I was 10 years old and was not surprised that my parents, who were from India and had a number of Indian acquaintances at the university, should ask Mr. Pirzada to share our meals. It was a small campus, with narrow brick walkways and white pillared buildings located on the fringes of what seemed to be an even smaller town. The supermarket did not carry mustard oil, doctors did not make house calls, neighbors never dropped by without an invitation, and of these things, every so often, my parents complained. In search of compatriots, they used to trail their fingers, at the start of each new semester, through the columns of the university directory, circling surnames familiar to their part of the world. It was in this manner that they discovered Mr. Pirzada and phoned him and invited him to our home. I have no memory of his first visit or of his second or his third, but by the end of September, I had grown so accustomed to Mr. Pirzada's presence in our living room that one evening, as I was dropping ice cubes into the water pitcher, I asked my mother to hand me a 4th glass from a cupboard still out of my reach.
She was busy at the stove, presiding over a skillet of fried spinach with radishes, and could not hear me because of the drone of the exhaust fan and the fierce scrapes of her spatula. I turned to my father, who was leaning against the refrigerator, eating spiced cashews from a cupped fist.
What is it, Lilia?
A glass for the Indian man.
Mr. Pirzada won't be coming today.
More importantly, Mr. Pirzada is no longer considered Indian, my father announced, brushing salt from the cashews out of his trim black beard. Not since partition. Our country was divided. 1947.
When I said I thought that was the date of India's independence from Britain, my father said,
That too. One moment we were free, and then we were sliced up,
he explained, drawing an X with his finger on the countertop,
like a pie. Hindus here, Muslims there. Dhaka no longer belongs to us.
He told me that during partition, Hindus and Muslims had set fire to each other's homes. For many, the idea of eating in the other's company was still unthinkable. It made no sense to me. Mr. Pirzada and my parents spoke the same language, laughed at the same jokes, looked more or less the same. They ate pickled mangoes with their meals, ate rice every night for supper with their hands. Like my parents, Mr. Pirzada took off his shoes before entering a room, chewed fennel seeds after meals as a digestive, drank no alcohol, for dessert dipped austere biscuits into successive cups of tea. Nevertheless, my father insisted that I understand the difference, and he led me to a map of the world taped to the wall over his desk. He seemed concerned that Mr. Pirzada might take offense if I accidentally referred to him as being Indian, though I could not really imagine Mr. Pirzada being offended by much of anything.
Mr. Pirzada is Bengali, but he is a Muslim, my father informed me. Therefore, he lives in East Pakistan, not India.
His finger trailed across the Atlantic, through Europe, the Mediterranean, the Middle East, and finally to the sprawling orange diamond that my mother once told me resembled a woman wearing a sari with her left arm extended. Various cities had been circled, with lines drawn between them to indicate my parents' travels and their place of birth. Calcutta was signified by a small silver star. I had been there only once and had no memory of the trip.
As you see, Lilia, it is a different country, a different color, my father said.
Pakistan was yellow, not orange. I noticed that there were two distinct parts to it, one much larger than the other, separated by an expanse of Indian territory. It was as if California and Connecticut constituted a nation apart from the U.S. My father rapped his knuckles on top of my head.
You are, of course, aware of the current situation? Aware of East Pakistan's fight for sovereignty?
I nodded, unaware of the situation. We returned to the kitchen, where my mother was draining a pot of boiled rice into a colander. My father opened up the can on the counter and eyed me sharply over the frames of his glasses as he ate some more cashews.
What exactly do they teach you at that school? Do you study history? Geography?
Lydia has plenty to learn at school, my mother said. We live here now. She was born here. She seemed genuinely proud of the fact, as if it were a reflection of my character. In her estimation, I knew, I was assured a safe life, an easy life, a fine education, every opportunity. I would never have to eat rationed food, or obey curfews, or watch riots from my rooftop, or hide neighbors in water tanks to prevent them from being shot, as she and my father had. Imagine having to place her in a decent school. Imagine her having to read during power failures by the light of kerosene lamps. Imagine the pressures, the tutors, the constant exams. She ran a hand through her hair, bobbed to a suitable length for her part-time job as a bank teller. How can you possibly expect her to know about partition? Put those nuts away.
But what does she learn about the world?
My father rattled the cashew can in his hand.
What is she learning?
We learned American history, of course, and American geography. That year, and every year, it seemed, we began by studying the Revolutionary War. We were taken in school buses on field trips to visit Plymouth Rock and to walk the Freedom Trail and to climb to the top of Bunker Hill Monument. We made dioramas out of colored construction paper depicting George Washington crossing the choppy waters of the Delaware River, and we made puppets of King George, wearing white tights and a black bow in his hair. During tests, we were given blank maps of the 13 colonies,
and asked to fill in names, dates, capitals. I could do it with my eyes closed. The next evening, Mr. Pirzada arrived, as usual, at 6 o'clock. Though they were no longer strangers, upon first greeting each other, he and my father maintained the habit of shaking hands.
"Come in, sir. Lilia, Mr. Pirzada's coat, please."
He stepped into the foyer, impeccably suited and scarved, with a silk tie knotted at his collar. Each evening he appeared in ensembles of plums, olives, and chocolate browns. He was a compact man, and though his feet were perpetually splayed and his belly slightly wide, he nevertheless maintained an efficient posture, as if balancing in either hand two suitcases of equal weight. His ears were insulated by tufts of graying hair that seemed to block out the unpleasant traffic of life. He had thickly lashed eyes shaded with a trace of camphor, a generous mustache that turned up playfully at the ends, and a mole shaped like a flattened raisin in the very center of his left cheek. On his head, he wore a black fez made from the wool of Persian lambs, secured by bobby pins, without which I was never to see him. Though my father always offered to fetch him in our car, Mr. Pirzada preferred to walk from his dormitory to our neighborhood, a distance of about 20 minutes on foot. Studying trees and shrubs on his way, and when he entered our house, his knuckles were pink with the effects of crisp autumn air.
"Another refugee, I am afraid, on Indian territory." "They are estimating 9 million at the last count," my father said.
Mr. Pirzada handed me his coat, for it was my job to hang it on the rack at the bottom of the stairs. It was made of finely checkered gray and blue wool, with a striped lining and horn buttons, and carried in its weave the faint smell of limes. There were no recognizable tags inside, only a hand-stitched label with the phrase, "Z. Saeed Suitors," embroidered on it in cursive with glossy black thread. On certain days, a birch or maple leaf was tucked into a pocket. He unlaced his shoes and lined them against the baseboard. A golden paste clung to the toes and heels, the result of walking through our damp, unraked lawn. Relieved of his trappings, he grazed my throat with his short, restless fingers, the way a person feels for solidity behind a wall before driving in a nail. Then he followed my father to the living room, where the television was tuned to the local news. As soon as they were seated, my mother appeared from the kitchen with a plate of mincemeat kebabs with coriander chutney. Mr. Pirzada popped one into his mouth.
"One can only hope," he said, reaching for another,
"that Dhaka's refugees are as heartily fed. Which reminds me." He reached into his suit pocket and gave me a small plastic egg filled with cinnamon hearts.
"For the lady of the house," he said with an almost imperceptible, splay-footed bow.
"Really, Mr. Pirzada," my mother protested, "night after night you spoil her."
"I only spoil children who are incapable of spoiling."
It was an awkward moment for me, one which I awaited in part with dread, in part with delight. I was charmed by the presence of Mr. Pirzada's rotund elegance and flattered by the faint theatricality of his attentions, yet unsettled by the superb ease of his gestures, which made me feel for an instant like a stranger in my own home. It had become our ritual, and for several weeks, before we grew more comfortable with one another, it was the only time he spoke to me directly. I had no response, offered no comment, betrayed no visible reaction to the steady stream of honey-filled lozenges, the raspberry truffles, the slender rolls of sour pastilles. I could not even thank him. For once, when I did, for an especially spectacular peppermint lollipop wrapped in a spray of purple cellophane, he had demanded,
"What is this, thank you? The lady at the bank thanks me. The cashier at the shop thanks me. The librarian thanks me when I return an overdue book. The overseas operator thanks me as she tries to connect me to Dhaka and fails. If I am buried in this country, I will be thanked, no doubt, at my funeral."
It was inappropriate, in my opinion, to consume the candy Mr. Pirzada gave me in a casual manner. I coveted each evening's treasure as I would a jewel or a coin from a buried kingdom, and I would place it in a small keepsake box made of carved sandalwood beside my bed, in which, long ago in India, my father's mother used to store the ground areca nuts she ate after her morning bath. It was my only memento of a grandmother I had never known, and until Mr. Pirzada came to our lives, I could find nothing to put inside it. Every so often before brushing my teeth and laying out my clothes for school the next day,
I opened the lid of the box and ate one of his treats. That night, like every night, we did not eat at the dining table, because it did not provide an unobstructed view of the television set. Instead, we huddled around the coffee table without conversing, our plates perched on the edges of our knees. From the kitchen, my mother brought forth the succession of dishes: lentils with fried onions, green beans with coconut, fish cooked with raisins in a yogurt sauce. I followed with the water glasses, and the plate of lemon wedges, and the chili peppers, purchased on monthly trips to Chinatown and stored by the pound in the freezer, which they like to snap open and crush into their food. Before eating, Mr. Pirzada always did a curious thing. He took out a plain silver watch without a band, which he kept in his breast pocket, held it briefly to one of his tufted ears, and wound it with three swift flicks of his thumb and forefinger. Unlike the watch on his wrist, the pocket watch, he had explained to me, was set to the local time in Dhaka, 11 hours ahead. For the duration of the meal, the watch rested on his folded paper napkin on the coffee table. He never seemed to consult it. Now that I had learned Mr. Pirzada was not an Indian, I began to study him with extra care to try to figure out what made him different. I decided that the pocket watch was one of those things. When I saw it that night, as he wound it and arranged it on the coffee table, an uneasiness possessed me. Life, I realized, was being lived in Dhaka first. I imagined Mr. Pirzada's daughters rising from sleep, tying ribbons in their hair, anticipating breakfast, preparing for school. Our meals, our actions, were only a shadow of what had already happened there, a lagging ghost of where Mr. Pirzada really belonged. At 6:30, which was when the national news began, my father raised the volume and adjusted the antennas. Usually, I occupied myself with a book, but that night my father insisted that I pay attention. On the screen, I saw tanks rolling through dusty streets and fallen buildings and forests of unfamiliar trees into which East Pakistani refugees had fled, seeking safety over the Indian border. I saw boats with fan-shaped sails floating on wide, coffee-colored rivers, a barricaded university, newspaper offices burnt to the ground. I turned to look at Mr. Pirzada. The images flashed in miniature across his eyes. As he watched, he had an immovable expression on his face, composed but alert, as if someone were giving him directions to an unknown destination. During the commercial, my mother went into the kitchen to get more rice, and my father and Mr. Pirzada deplored the policies of a general named Yahya Khan. They discussed intrigues I did not know, a catastrophe I could not comprehend.
"See, children your age, what they do to survive?"
my father said as he served me another piece of fish. But I could no longer eat. I could only steal glances at Mr. Pirzada, sitting beside me in his olive-green jacket, calmly creating a well in his rice to make room for a second helping of lentils. He was not my notion of a man burdened by such grave concerns. I wondered if the reason he was always so smartly dressed was in preparation to endure with dignity whatever news assailed him, perhaps even to attend a funeral at a moment's notice. I wondered, too, what would happen if suddenly his seven daughters were to appear on television, smiling and waving and blowing kisses to Mr. Pirzada from a balcony. I imagined how relieved he would be. But this never happened. That night, when I placed the plastic egg filled with cinnamon hearts in the box beside my bed, I did not feel the ceremonious satisfaction I normally did. I tried not to think about Mr. Pirzada in his lime-scented overcoat, connected to the unruly, sweltering world we had viewed a few hours ago in our bright, carpeted living room. And yet, for several moments, that was all I could think about. My stomach tightened, and I worried whether his wife and seven daughters were now members of the drifting, clamoring crowd that had flashed at intervals on the screen. In an effort to banish the image, I looked around my room, at the yellow canopied bed with matching flounced curtains, at framed glass pictures mounted on white and violet papered walls, at the penciled inscriptions by the closet door where my father recorded my height on each of my birthdays. But the more I tried to distract myself, the more I began to convince myself that Mr. Prasada's family was in all likelihood dead. Eventually,
I took a square of white chocolate out of the box and unwrapped it. And then I did something I had never done before. I put the chocolate in my mouth, letting it soften until the last possible moment. And then as I chewed it slowly, I prayed that Mr. Pirzada's family was safe and sound. I had never prayed for anything before. Had never been taught or told to. But I decided, given the circumstances, that it was something I should do. That night when I went to the bathroom, I only pretended to brush my teeth, for I feared that I would somehow rinse the prayer out as well. I wet the brush and rearranged the tube of paste to prevent my parents from asking any questions, and fell asleep with sugar on my tongue. No one at school talked about the war followed so faithfully in my living room. We continued to study the American Revolution and learned about the injustices of taxation without representation and memorized passages from the Declaration of Independence. During recess, the boys would divide in two groups, chasing each other wildly around the swings and seesaws, redcoats against the colonies. In the classroom, our teacher, Mrs. Kenyon, pointed frequently to a map that emerged like a movie screen from the top of the chalkboard, charting the route of the Mayflower, or showing us the location of the Liberty Bell. Each week, two members of the class gave a report on a particular aspect of the revolution, and so one day I was sent to the school library with my friend Dora to learn about the surrender at Yorktown. Mrs. Kenyon handed us a slip of paper with the names of three books to look up in the card catalog. We found them right away and sat down at a low round table to read and take notes. But I could not concentrate. I returned to the blonde wood shelves to a section I had noticed labeled Asia. I saw books about China, India, Indonesia, Korea. Eventually, I found a book titled Pakistan, A Land and Its People. I sat on a footstool and opened the book. The laminated jacket crackled in my grip. I began turning the pages, filled with photos of rivers and rice fields and men in military uniforms. There was a chapter about Dhaka, and I began to read about its rainfall and its jute production. I was studying a population chart when Dora appeared in the aisle. "What are you doing back here? Mrs. Kenyon's in the library. She came to check up on us." I slammed the book shut too loudly. Mrs. Kenyon emerged, the aroma of her perfume filling up the tiny aisle, and lifted the book by the tip of its spine as if it were a hair clinging to my sweater. She glanced at the cover, then at me. "Is this book a part of your report, Lilia?" "No, Mrs. Kenyon." "Then I see no reason to consult it," she said, replacing it in the slim gap on the shelf. "Do you?" As weeks passed, it grew more and more rare to see any footage from Dhaka on the news. The report came after the first set of commercials, sometimes the second. The press had been censored, removed, restricted, rerouted. Some days, many days, only a death toll was announced, prefaced by a reiteration of the general situation. More poets were executed, more villages set ablaze. In spite of it all, night after night, my parents and Mr. Pirzada enjoyed long, leisurely meals. After the television was shut off and the dishes washed and dried, they joked and told stories and dipped biscuits in their tea. When they tired of discussing political matters, they discussed instead the progress of Mr. Pirzada's book about the deciduous trees of New England, and my father's nomination for tenure, and the peculiar eating habits of my mother's American co-workers at the bank. Eventually, I was sent upstairs to do my homework, but through the carpet, I heard them as they drank more tea and listened to cassettes of Kishore Kumar and played Scrabble on the coffee table, laughing and arguing long into the night about the spellings of English words. I wanted to join them, wanted above all to console Mr. Pirzada somehow. But apart from eating a piece of candy for the sake of his family and praying for their safety, there was nothing I could do. They played Scrabble until the 11 o'clock news, and then, sometime around midnight, Mr. Pirzada walked back to his dormitory. For this reason, I never saw him leave. But each night, as I drifted off to sleep, I would hear them, anticipating the birth of a nation on the other side of the world. One day in October, Mr. Pirzada asked upon arrival, "What are these large orange vegetables on people's doorsteps? A type of squash?" "Pumpkins," my mother replied. "Lilia, remind me to pick one up at the supermarket." "And the purpose?"
It indicates what?
You make a jack-o'-lantern, I said, grinning ferociously, like this, to scare people away.
I see, Mr. Pirzada said, grinning back. Very useful. The next day, my mother bought a 10-pound pumpkin, fat and round, and placed it on the dining table. Before supper, while my father and Mr. Pirzada were watching the local news, she told me to decorate it with markers, but I wanted to carve it properly, like others I had noticed in the neighborhood.
Yes, let's carve it, Mr. Pirzada agreed, and rose from the sofa. Hang the news tonight.
Asking no questions, he walked into the kitchen, opened a drawer, and returned, bearing a long, serrated knife. He glanced at me for approval.
Shall I?
I nodded. For the first time, we all gathered around the dining table. My mother, my father, Mr. Pirzada, and I. While the television aired unattended, we covered the tabletop with newspapers. Mr. Pirzada draped his jacket over the chair behind him, removed a pair of opal cufflinks, and rolled up the starched sleeves of his shirt.
First, go round the top like this, I instructed, demonstrating with my index finger.
He made an initial incision and drew the knife around. When he had come full circle, he lifted the cap by the stem. It loosened effortlessly, and Mr. Pirzada leaned over the pumpkin for a moment to inspect and inhale its contents. My mother gave him a long metal spoon with which he gutted the interior until the last bits of string and seeds were gone. My father, meanwhile, separated the seeds from the pulp and set them out to dry on a cookie sheet so that we could roast them later on. I drew two triangles against the ridged surface for the eyes, which Mr. Pirzada dutifully carved, and crescents for eyebrows, and another triangle for the nose. The mouth was all that remained, and the teeth posed a challenge. I hesitated.
Smile or frown? I asked.
You choose, Mr. Pirzada said. As a compromise, I drew a kind of grimace straight across, neither mournful nor friendly. Mr. Pirzada began carving without the least bit of intimidation, as if he had been carving jack-o'-lanterns his whole life. He had nearly finished when the national news began. The reporter mentioned Dhaka, and we all turned to listen. An Indian official announced that unless the world helped to relieve the burden of East Pakistani refugees, India would have to go to war against Pakistan. The reporter's face dripped with sweat as he relayed the information. He did not wear a tie or a jacket, dressed instead as if he himself were about to take part in the battle. He shielded his scorched face as he hollered things to the cameraman. The knife slipped from Mr. Pizzata's hand and made a gash, dipping toward the base of the pumpkin.
Please forgive me.
He raised a hand to one side of his face, as if someone had slapped him there.
It is terrible. I will buy another. We will try again.
Not at all, not at all, my father said. He took the knife from Mr. Pirzada and carved around the gash, evening it out, dispensing altogether with the teeth I had drawn. What resulted was a disproportionately large hole the size of a lemon, so that our jack-o'-lantern wore an expression of placid astonishment, the eyebrows no longer fierce, floating in frozen surprise above a vacant geometric gaze.